This episode of The Tome Show is brought to you by Noble Knight Games, where Out of Print is available again. And listeners like you, thanks for using The Tome's Amazon store.
Hi, I'm Ed Greenwood, and you're listening to The Tome.
Welcome to The Tome, episode 180. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interview show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner.
And I'm Tracy Hurley, and in this episode, we're going to go to the library, dust off our membership cards, start a stopwatch, and do some D&D book mini-reviews. So who's providing these mini-reviews? Well, certainly myself and Jeff. Beyond that, I guess it depends on who sends them in between now and next week when we hope to get this released.
So if you're interested in sending something in, hopefully you're paying attention to the Twitter, and I think the previous episode we mentioned it as well, which hopefully we can get that out soon. Let's talk some news. There was, as of, recently anyway, there was an announcement in the Rule of Three article on DDI about the Mordenkainen, or Mordenkainen, however you want to pronounce it, his Magnificent Emporium book, and that it was taken off the schedule. It was one of those books that was sort of canceled and disappeared and was going to be folded into DDI articles. And now it's been put back on the schedule, and it is coming out after all. But they've decided to release it as a friendly local game store only release. So you can only get it from your hobby and game stores. You won't be able to get it from Barnes & Noble, or I'm assuming you won't be able to get it from like Amazon or whatever as well.
Right, that's what I'm assuming as well.
I know I got myself caught into a bit of a hoopla earlier today on this topic, as as people were asking all kinds of questions about it, and I sort of just said okay, but it's one book, so I'm not going to get all worked up. Or, you know, I understand, I sympathize. As somebody who lived many many years in a small town that didn't have a game store, and didn't want to have to drive an hour or so to the nearest game store. I understand this concern that there's a big chunk of the country that this book just can't be sold to.
Right.
Or at least not easily. And on one hand, that has questionable benefit to the brand and to the company, right? But I guess the point I was trying to make in the conversation is that I don't know their business. And if they see that at least occasionally with things like this, supporting the friendly local game store business is good for them in the long run, then maybe that's the way they're going to go. Or maybe there's another reason for it. I don't know. But that's the point, is that I don't know, and it's one book. If they go this way with all of their books, that might be an area of concern. But to do this kind of thing every now and then, I mean, I guess they technically did it with some of those collectible or special minis sets too, right? You could only get Orcus in game stores. You could only get, I think maybe the Beholders were the same way. So, I mean, you do this once or twice a year. It doesn't seem like a huge deal to me. If it starts becoming the norm, then I get worried, maybe.
Yeah. And I mean, so there's difficulties with people who don't live in the U.S., but at least within the U.S., a fair number of gaming stores also have an online presence. So it's still possible to get it online, even if Amazon's not carrying it.
Yeah. In fact, our sponsor, Noble Knight, is a friendly local game store that is also has an online store. So theoretically, you could go there and get it and tell them that we sent you.
Yeah.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. With a huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more, Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.noblenight.com or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items.
It's an interesting thing. I'd like to see how it plays out, and if it, you know, sometimes some other people need help too, and in this case it could be the local game stores or whatnot.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, I think I understand the areas of concern. I understand all of, I don't understand WotC's sort of business model and why they're doing it, but I assume they know their business better than I do.
Yeah.
It does sort of raise the continual question of, did WotC communicate this information in the best way possible?
That was the interesting thing, because it was in a rule of three
right
question, you know, rather than an editorial or something like it was kind of buried in there.
It was buried, and it's largely unexplained.
Right.
And I feel like, I don't know, it's sort of been my impression that the biggest of all the conversations that are had about what's good about 4th edition, what's bad about 4th edition, what, you know, the strength of the D&D brand and the weaknesses of the D&D brand and all these things that geeks like to discuss, right? I've very firmly believed that, at least for the last several years, the biggest fault of 4th edition has been and continues to be in many ways the PR. Now, I feel like they've worked on it. I feel like they've gotten better, but I still feel like there's a long ways to go in the way that they as a company communicate with the fans.
Right.
So. But you work for them, so you're not going to speak to that.
Don't work for Wizards of the Coast.
No, but you do work for Open Design sometimes.
Yeah, I freelance there.
Talk about that. That's a segue.
I know. It's very, very good. Kobold Quarterly issue number 18 is out this summer, right before Gen Con mega issue. And I have an article in there. Lots of people have some really good articles in there.
What's your article about?
Mine is the ecology of minotaurs.
That's awesome. I like the old ecology articles from way back when.
Yeah, I tried to look at some of them before I wrote this one. And then I just had fun with writing about minotaurs.
You know, it had its faults, but my favorite monster ecology articles, and this is me reminiscing and being nostalgic for a bit, was a whole series of them that they had with a group of wizards called the Monster Hunters.
Okay.
And they would just write the article as a short story of these monster hunters that were always, you know, bumbling and messing things up, right? And making fun of each other and what have you, trying to capture whatever the monster was and discussing it as they go along. But there wasn't really any content or ecology sort of stuff in the actual story. But then it was just laced with footnotes. There were like 5 to 10 footnotes per page giving you all the little details and how the short story sort of they mentioned one thing and then they would give a footnote sort of explaining it, you know?
Right.
Those I always thought were really fun and interesting reads.
Yeah, I think the Minotaur one, the original one that I read, was like that. That's not how we decided to do this particular article.
No, but I didn't figure you would. I mean, I'm not saying you should have. That was I think, you know, one guy's sort of style, and I thought it was really entertaining. But
yeah, no, it was pretty. I've seen a couple of those, and they're pretty entertaining. But yeah, and Phil, Chatty DM, has an article in here too.
Uh-huh.
Matt James.
Matt James. Anyway, go on.
Oh, I just lots of people.
And Matt James's article is sort of a, I almost feel like it's an addendum or a follow-up to his Soldiers of Fortune book. It deals with siege weapons and all that, which he also dealt with heavily in Soldiers of Fortune.
Yeah.
Which people can pick up now. I was thinking that I would pick up my copy of Cold War Quarterly at Gen Con.
That'd be good.
I don't do the subscription anymore, and I kind of feel silly ordering one and getting it in the mail now, since I'm going to be at Gen Con in, what is it, a couple weeks now?
Right.
So I'll just pick it up there and then walk around with it and have everybody sign it.
Yeah, you should do that.
Right on. All right, well, people should go get it.
Yeah, and I think I'm trying to see who else was in here.
There was a bunch of people mentioned. A lot of the social media folks, the bloggers and podcaster community.
Yeah, Monty Cook and Skip Williams are also in it. They have their normal columns. So let's take a break here to talk about our sponsor for the episode, Noble Knight Games. Game Store that specializes in bringing you great prices on things that are new, as well as finding things that are out of print or hard to find. And by being a brick-and-mortar store as well as online, that means they're able to get the local game store-only items as well as the rest of the game products you love.
Which we discussed. And we'll see how that goes. I know with the giant Orcus, there were some limitations on whether they could sell them in the online store or not, I think. So I'm not going to promise you right now, I haven't talked to them, that they're going to have Mordenkainen's Magnificent Emporium. But it's probably worth taking a look.
Totally.
For our picks for this episode, I thought it would be appropriate for Tracy and I to give you our pick for our favorite D&D novel or book of inspiration that Noble Knight has. And I'm going to go back to my first experience with a D&D novel, and I'm going to go classic with the Avatar trilogy. Although I've been reading some newer stuff lately that's been really, really good, maybe just as good if not better, but I have this sort of... I haven't actually reread the Avatar trilogy since probably middle school, but I have this sense of nostalgia and what I loved about it. And it was a series of books that first introduced me to the Forgotten Realms, and it sort of deals with what happens when the gods get kicked out of their domains and have to walk in the world until these artifacts, the Tablets of Fate, are returned. Gods end up dying and changing and getting absorbed into other gods, and new gods are created, and the mortals, of course, of the world play a big role in it. So... I've always sort of enjoyed that kind of a story. In a fantasy story, I really like big, epic sort of things that deal with the gods and all that. I think that's why I'm enjoying the Erebus Kale trilogy as well. And despite these being out of print and sometimes hard to find, Noble Knight has all of these books running between $3 and $8, depending on the book and how good of a quality of the book you need. Tracy, what's your pick?
So I don't have quite the experience with novels that you do, but I am picking The God Catcher by Aaron M. Evans, because I read that and I just totally liked it. I think I may pick this as my book for our book club.
Okay, so if you wanted to get a head start on the book club, Tracy's thinking we might be doing this one, let's see, we finish Erebus Kale in August, so we would be doing this in September?
Yeah.
Okay.
So don't read it now, because you'll probably forget by September.
I know I've got lots of other things to keep me busy. I probably don't have time to read it now anyway. But
yeah. Well, I know we've got two books right now, right?
Yeah. We've got to have two books read and ready to record about next week.
So yeah.
Get on that. You said you're a quarter of the way through the Elminster book?
Yes.
And how far are you into Erebus Kale, the second book?
I want to say it's halfway.
Okay. Very good.
So I'm on pace.
You might make it. The little teaser for what we're going to talk about next week with the book club. The Erebus Kale book, the second book, I felt didn't move as much or as quickly as the first one did. But the last chapter has some big things that almost make up for it all. So get ready for that.
I will.
All right. Well, let's get into it. So Tracy and I are now going to talk about a book called The Kobold's Guide to Game Design, an open design book, open design, which publishes Kobold Quarterly, which Tracy's been published in just recently, as well as their patronage open design projects like The Lost City, which Tracy was also published in because she's a rock star. So, Tracy, what is the Kobold... Well, we're going to specifically talk about Kobold's Guide to Game Design, Volume 3, because we've both read that one.
Right.
What is it? Go. What is the Kobold's Guide to Game Design?
1, 2, 3, go. No, they're I guess it's a collection of essays about game design, usually around a theme. So Kobold Guide to Game Design number 3, I'm trying to remember what the theme is, Tools and Techniques. This one had a little more, I think, broad topic-wise for the different essays. I don't know beyond that how to explain it other than, do you have anything?
I know I got a lot out of the discussion on world building and some of the, because they talked a lot about sort of how to build a world, and I mean they had in some, it's essays from other people, right? Like Ed Greenwood wrote an article on world building and how to make sort of individual little locations feel more alive. But it also talks about when you're going to work on a project in general anyway, right?
Yeah.
There's a great essay from Wolfgang Bauer about, you know, this is sort of the cycles that you go through when you're working on a project, on a game project. This is what you do, and this is how you go, what you go through, and this is sort of what you're going to feel as you're working on this project. And these are the hurdles you have to get through. And if you can get through these hurdles, then you can finish the project. If you don't, the project will get to about halfway and then die off, and you'll lose interest or whatever. And I found it to be pretty accurate with my experiences, and I found a lot of it inspiring and interesting.
Yeah, so he goes a lot into why a writer gets paid to write, because if you don't write, and I mean, I was this way too probably before I started doing some freelancing, you know, you're like, oh, I know how to write. I can just write this. I don't understand why there's this big deal. And, you know, sure, the first week or two of the project, you're like, yeah, I'm really into this. And then by week 3, 4, 5, 6, you're just like, when is this project going to end? I'm done. I'm so tired of this. And that part, the fact mm-hmm. that you have to keep writing when you're feeling that way is why you get paid as a writer.
Yep, I agree. And my problem is, and where I relate to that is I start projects and then I always end up coming up with projects that are really big rather than start with little things.
You know, right.
When I do little things, I can usually put it together decently well, right? Like we did the Christmas adventures, right?
Mm-hmm.
And put that together, you know, a week's worth of work in and out, done. Within an evening, I put together that PDF for this feed, right? The Anguillians, which I didn't have to do any of the writing or design work on, right? But I did the editing and the layouts and all that kind of stuff, and I threw that together tonight. Nice short little projects I can get done. What happens is I'm a busy guy, and so rather than lose interest in things, I end up trying to do these big projects and then get busy and have to do other things. And,
right.
then come back to it and do a little bit more and then get busy and come back to it later. And, you know, and so I sort of slowly but surely in chunks get more and more done. But that's certainly not an efficient way of getting a project done.
Right. Another one of the chapters I really liked was The Myths and Realities of Game Balance by Monty Cook.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was a really, really good chapter.
Yeah,
too.
Summarize that one for me. It's been a while since I've read it.
Yeah, I have to go. Like, I remember just briefly, like, it's talking about, like, a good GM, or I guess maybe a game designer, can design something for wildly disparate levels.
Mm-hmm.
But let me see. But that's not necessarily what you're looking for either when you talk about balance.
Right. Yeah, and balance is always a bit of a tricky thing to handle anyway. And Monty Cook knows a lot about game design as an author. And so, I mean, he's a great guy to have writing about it, but he also has different approaches to game design than some people. I think it's important when you read these kind of books to know who you're reading and the different approach they might have, right?
Right.
Monty Cook is a great game designer. He helped design a lot of what's in third edition, which became 3.5 and Pathfinder, and continues to work in those areas. Heck of a game designer. But the person who designed third edition D&D clearly wasn't looking for the same experience as the people who designed fourth edition D&D or first or second edition D&D, right? And so I think it's also interesting to note his style as it comes through these essays. You know, he's advocating for a certain way of doing things, which makes a lot of sense for him and his style.
Right. You know? Yeah, so one of the things he talks about is the myth of game balance being that they're kind of, first of all, balance means multiple things in a game, depending on what you want, and then whether or not you can ever have a game system that brings that balance rather than the DM or doing it.
Very good. So,
and talks a little bit about social contracts and stuff too.
Yeah. Yeah. Here's my question then.
Okay.
I really enjoyed this book, and I don't know, I feel like we're not really doing it great justice, or maybe I'm not doing it great justice, but I really enjoyed the book, and I thought it was interesting and engaging and inspiring to me personally. But is this a book for anybody? Is this a book for DMs? Is this a book for people who want to work in the game industry? Who would you recommend this book to?
The first level is definitely anybody who wants to work in the game industry. Hands down, I think you totally should buy this.
Mm-hmm.
And it helped me a lot. I read this book, I think, last Gen Con. And then I started doing some freelancing, getting Lost City and stuff like that. And it really helped me understand not only what was expected of me, but also understanding the terminology that people were using when they were talking. Like, if Logan or Wolfgang or somebody was talking about something, it made it a lot easier for me to understand what they were talking about. Because, you know, otherwise I had never, it was like getting a few years experience just from reading it to me.
Mm-hmm.
I also like it. This one's a little harder for this, but and the other two for sure, I really liked as a game master, as a GM. I felt that they really helped me understand how and where to push the bounds of the role-playing games that I was playing, particularly D&D. So I would recommend it for that too, particularly the ones that talk about the different styles, you know, sandbox. They talk about that a little bit in this one, but they talk about it even more, I think, in older ones.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the other two, because I really felt like Volume 3 really focused. I mean, I think there's some things in there that are going to be good for DMs in general or GMs in general. But I felt like it was mostly extra good for people who wanted to do any sort of design, whether you're doing it because you want to be a freelancer or go get a job at WotC, or, you know, you want to run a blog and create some things every now and then to share with the public. But I think if you're going to design for the public, and work on gaming projects, so to speak, I think it's a good book to read.
Right.
And you say that volumes 1 and 2 are that and at the same time, big enough and general enough that probably even really useful just to DMs or GMs in general, not just people who are looking to do design.
Yeah, so Volume 2 says it's about pitching, playtesting, and publishing, but I remember when I read it, because I mean, GMs do a lot of that too, so there are things like maps, monsters, and bottom-up design, and how not to design a magic item, that while, you know, useful for writing, I think are also useful for DMs, at least for me. Volume 1 has a lot of really good stuff, I think, for GMs in general. That's the one where they really go into world building, stagecraft to play as a thing, just how to bring this sort of stuff to life. So if I were a DM, I would definitely get Volume 1, but just be cognizant of when it came out.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And they are, I'm looking through the Kobold Quarterly store here, I think $19 in print and $15 in PDF, still available.
Yeah.
So I actually picked up Volume 1 and 3 at Gen Con last year and really enjoyed reading at least Volume 3. I haven't gotten to 1 yet. I'm going backwards, I guess.
And Volume 1 was written in 2008, so that's what I mean by keeping cognizant of when it comes out.
Yep. The whims of game design change with the times, right?
Well, and this is before 4A. Some of this stuff was written in 2007.
Yeah.
So if you're looking for 4A specific advice, it's not going to be a...
Sure. Absolutely. All right. Well, that's the Kobold Guide to Game Design.
Sweet.
So let's talk a little bit about Sword of the Gods. Sword of the Gods is a Forgotten Realms novel by Bruce Cordell that is connected to the Abyssal Plague. It is, in fact, the only Abyssal Plague story that I've read.
Okay.
For various reasons. But I wanted to pick this one up because I've enjoyed Bruce Cordell's work in the past. And I got some information from him through his Facebook page, where he explained that the character that he introduced in this book was going to be the subject of a series unassociated with the Abyssal Plague.
Okay.
So I want to sort of get to know this character. Damascus is the main character, and he is a Deva, which automatically comes with some interesting situations. But he's a Deva who my interpretation is that he has the epic destiny, or when he's up at that power level, he has the epic destiny of Punisher of the Gods. He works for the gods, going out and doing their messy work that they don't want to be, you know, dirty their hands with. And so he has these flashbacks of his previous lives of being this really powerful thing, you know, and fighting a massive, you know, dragon, or discussing things with the agents of the gods and having the gods ask him for help and all these kinds of things. But when this book opens, he's actually, you know, he's a newly reborn Deva. So he has no memories. He's, you know, low level, if you want to put it into game terms, right? And he's just trying to figure out who the heck he is and what's going on. But meanwhile, there's a Rakshasa who is hunting him and who knows him. That's they explain the difference between the Devas and their evil counterparts, is that the evil counterparts remember everything when they're reborn, because they can't, you know, they can't forget their sins by death. They have to constantly always remember them. And so this guy is trying to take him down. And meanwhile, Damascus is running around trying to figure out who he is and what's going on, and why did, you know, he finds one of his main, he's got a few sort of main magic items or whatever that he always has. There's a sword, there's a scarf, and there's a box full of, there's a box full of tokens and a ring. And
okay.
And so this is really all about him trying to figure out who he is and what's going on, while simultaneously dealing with these creatures that I believe are related to the Abyssal Plague, coming from this fossilized dimension that have escaped and are trying to wreak havoc in the world.
Cool.
But then he's also got this other plot, which is really probably the main plot, of this other Rakshasa character who's out there trying to manipulate things and kill him, or do horrible things to him, or whatever. I think ultimately, and we don't know this yet, but I think ultimately he's actually trying to turn Damascus and get him to do evil things and become a Rakshasa himself.
Okay.
I think that's what it's really all about. But so yeah, it's really cool because you have these flashes of really epic power, but then you're dealing with these small sort of character stories. You know, he hooks up with a couple of thieves. I'm interpreting them both as being, you know, rogue, thief sort of characters. But it's an air spur, so they're not exactly your typical, you know, one of them's an air genasi, so she's always, you know, floating around and flying and doing all kinds of crazy stuff. So yeah, I mean, if Devas on their own have this sort of inborn interesting story going on, and the way he's done this one, I think, is interesting. It does raise a few questions, right? Because this is the first time, at least since fourth edition, that they sort of openly acknowledge that the world of the Forgotten Realms is not alone, because Damascus has been on many worlds and worked for many gods. And actually, one of the main magic items that he tries to give himself, which helps him give him all of his memories back, is called the Whirl of Ioun. And Ioun is not a Forgotten Realms god. He's a Greyhawk god.
Okay.
And so you have it does open up all kinds of those questions, right? Of, well, hey, suddenly you're giving me all this stuff about, you know, multiversal sort of stuff, and you're acknowledging that openly in a novel, which hasn't been done since the fourth edition days. So anyway, what questions do you have? I've rambled.
I have no idea.
Does it sound interesting to you?
Yeah. Well, and I like Bruce, so I'll read anything he writes.
Yeah. I have three things to discuss for this episode, and two of them are written by Bruce. All right. Let's do yours next.
Okay. So mine is a book called Play on Safe.
What is Play on Safe? This is... Now, do I understand this is not actually a D&D book, but more of a book of inspiration?
Yeah, this is not a D&D book. It doesn't have the author's name in here. It's Graham Walmsley. I don't know if I'm pronouncing his last name correctly. But it's more of a book on how to do improv in gaming. So, you know, when you're at the table and you want to improvise more of your story, whether you're a GM or a player, this gives a bunch of ideas of how to do that.
So it's a book all about improv and how to do improv specifically for gaming?
Yeah, or like how to be willing to, you know, go outside of your comfort area of looking at your character sheet and only doing what you've already decided your character will or will not do, and just telling stories at the table without advanced planning, without stopping the story of somebody else, how to work together to build stories, how to make things interesting, and just things like that that I really liked and I thought was great. Like, he has this one bit where he says, be obvious. So one of the problems that newer role players, and maybe even older ones, I don't know, I only know my own experience, is that you're afraid of looking silly or stupid, so you try to be really awesome. And oftentimes that kind of fails because you end up trying to build this big story that, you know, after a while it just doesn't really make much sense because you're trying to railroad everybody into one direction. So instead you could just, like, open up, say whatever seems obvious to you. Like, he has this example of something that they were getting, like a map or something that was going to be written in blood. So it made total sense to have that be... the paper itself to be parchment made from the skin of the victims of this evil bad guy. You know, mm-hmm. the player who said this thought it was totally obvious that that's what you would do, but nobody else thought that way. And they're like, wow, that's really cool. Where if he had spent, you know, 5 minutes trying to come up with something that was quote unquote awesome, one, that scene may never have happened, and two, may not have been as good.
Well, it sounds to me like this could... be just about as useful to DMs as it would be players, huh?
Yeah, definitely. Well, and part of it's how to play a game without doing a lot of prep work in advance, how to move with stories. There's a whole chapter called Tell Stories that does things like creating routines and breaking them, how to create platforms and add a tilt. So if you've ever heard of Fiasco, one of Fiasco's big things is the tilt, where, you know, things just go totally awry.
We're going to play some Fiasco at Gen Con.
I hope so.
I've decided. I want to play, and you're going to be in that game.
Okay.
Done.
And another big one they give that a lot of GMs might really like is he talks about status, you know, high-born versus low-born, and how to bring that out at the table through your actions and the words you use. And he gives some good tips there as well. So there's lots of this stuff in there. It's not a long book at all. Like, I usually read it within an hour, maybe two. But it's something you probably want to go back to and just keep playing with.
Okay, and if you read it within an hour or two, then for the rest of us, that's what, a couple days?
No. No, seriously, he even says it. I've seen him talk about it elsewhere. Like, it's easy to read through.
82 pages.
Yeah, and there's a lot of white space.
Right on. Well, that's caught my interest. I'll have to look for that when I'm at Gen Con this year and see if I can find it. Or otherwise, I do see it on Lulu, and I thought I saw it on Amazon as well.
Yeah.
So.
And eventually, when you have an iPad, there's a PDF version.
There is, yeah. I'm working on that. Excellent.
Okay.
Now I want to talk about The King of RPGs Volume 2. A while back, we did a discussion. There were three of us, I think, in that episode. I think this was before Tracy joined on as a co-host. But maybe you listened to the episode. I think I had Will Wong and Victor Cantu from Fistful Comics and Games on, yep. And we talked about King of RPGs Volume 1, and it is an American-made anime about gamers, if that makes sense.
Okay.
And it's not just tabletop gamers, but there's also video gaming, and there's board games and role-playing games, although my favorite parts are probably the role-playing bits. And the first one there's one main character who has this fundamental strength and flaw that he's the world's most perfect role player. And that's why the DM of the story just absolutely has to have him in his games, because as a DM, he wants to build the perfect gaming group, and this guy is the world's greatest role player. And that's, you know, that's great that he can do that, but at the same time, that's his big weakness, because he gets into his characters and he becomes these characters and starts doing stupid things. And it has actually been legally kicked off of the their version of World of Warcraft. I forget the name that they use for it, but it's their version of World of Warcraft. He's been kicked off of it because he was doing all kinds of horrible things, and it got way messy in real life. But then he gets introduced into tabletop gaming, and they deal with that a lot. And then there's this cop in the first volume that becomes sort of his nemesis. Go to volume 2 then, and I think I enjoyed volume 2 more than I enjoyed volume 1. Maybe it was just there were fewer silly hats. One of my big problems with the main characters, he's always wearing a stupid silly hat. But I also felt like there was actual movement and progression, and the character felt less like a stereotype and more like a person. And there were some cool things going on, and it dealt combination. Well, here's what it was, as they ended up going, he ended up sort of accidentally sitting down in front of a computer and playing again their version of World of Warcraft, and instantly gets sucked into it and becomes the character, and all hell breaks loose, and he ends up at MailCon, MAEL, because the company is Maelstrom as opposed to Blizzard, right?
Right.
He ends up at MailCon, where they're, instead of BlizzCon, where they're having a tournament to decide on the best player of the game. But the game has been run all this time by this super intelligent AI that they developed. And the AI has ulterior motives. And ultimately what happens is, as they're about to sort of conclude this thing and they're down to a final four in the tournament, the cop woman from Volume 1 rushes in and sets off an EMP and fries all the servers. And so the game's down worldwide. And so they can't finish the tournament. And so the DM from before sort of shows up and says, hey, how about this? We'll take their characters, convert them into basically D&D characters, and we'll run the rest of the tournament as a D&D game. And sort [S2] Right. [S1] Of, and remarkably, all the executives of the company sort of agree to it. And so then the second half of it is them running through this D&D game. And, you know, and I was impressed because as much as like sort of the side characters who I liked more in the first volume took a backseat in this one, the main character I felt like actually grew and developed, even if it was through this way over the top sort of role-playing situation. I don't know. I thought the first one had an audience and it wasn't quite me. But the second one I liked more than the first one. So
nice.
That's King of RPGs Volume 2. I know, yeah. Tracy's going to run out and buy it right now because she already has a copy.
Yeah.
So
I will get to it eventually.
You've got a full plate. In this segment, then, I want to talk about the Abolethic Sovereignty Trilogy. We've actually already done an episode on books 1 and 2 of the Abolethic Sovereignty. I believe it was Will Wong who read those and wanted to interview the author about it. And this is written by Bruce Cordell. And then book 3 came out and went and came and went, and we never really had a chance to go back and deal with it. But I went and read the whole trilogy, so I thought I'd mention sort of my thoughts on it briefly. I did actually do a series of 3 reviews on each of the books over at Fistful of Comics and Games. If you wanted to read those, we'll try to link them. But the Abolethic Sovereignty is a Forgotten Realms trilogy that deals a lot with the Far Realm. So if you want to have a Forgotten Realms story that heavily interacts with Cthulhoid creatures from beyond and has a heavy influence of the Feywild, and also sort of explains and gives some of the story of the Spell Plague and what happened and what it was like and how people were affected by it, this is a pretty good trilogy for doing all of those things.
Yeah.
It opens with the main character, who's a monk, or I call him the main character, Cain, who it starts pre-Spell Plague. The Spell Plague hits. It sort of explains what happens to him. Then you go a few years after the Spell Plague, and he starts looking at the world and seeing a lot of what's happening, and he's spell scarred, and they sort of go through a lot of explanation of that, but that it all ends up being connected to this hunt for aberrations that he was on, and that leads to a hunt for the Aboleths, who are trying to raise the city of Zifu out of the sea. And it turns out that the city of Zifu was just one seed planted in the world millennia ago, before the world was sort of done cooling, so to speak. And it was done only to eventually go back to its home, sort of far realm, weird dimension, and raise all of these other cities and bring them all to the world and destroy it. And the way to get there is through the Feywild, and the Eladrin have sort of set up a guard for the last, you know, thousands and thousands of years, constantly just sort of watching this rift to the far realm, making sure nothing comes through.
Yeah.
And it deals with warlocks and all of that. It deals with, there's a lot in here, and I thought it was handled very, very well.
I liked it.
You read it too?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, why didn't you say so? We could have teamed up on this one.
That's okay. I'd rather you do all the work and then just say, yeah, I read it too.
Well, I got 3 segments. You got 1. That's no fair. We should have, if I'd have known you'd have read it, we would have teamed up on that one.
Yeah, I read all 3 of these. I really liked it too.
Who's your main character? All right, who's your favorite character?
Can't remember the woman, right? Anusha?
Anusha?
Yeah, I liked her.
She bothered me.
Oh, yeah?
Mostly because when I read novels or books based on games, I want to at least be able to translate the characters into game characters, if that makes sense.
Okay.
And I don't know how to do that with her, because her power has, and her powers have nothing to do with anything that's possible in the world of D&D.
Might be why I like her.
Huh?
Might be why I like her.
It might be. Although, I mean, in terms of her personality, I find her interesting, because she started off as this sort of sweet little innocent girl.
Yeah, I know.
And then by the end, she's probably the most... She's not, like, jaded.
Mm-hmm.
But she's probably the most reasonable, most... almost realistic character in the whole bunch. Like, she's the person that I feel like is us.
Right.
You know, even with this whole love story between her and Japheth. Japheth, who's supposed to be sort of the bad boy, right, that she falls in love with early on.
Right.
He has this real sort of immature infatuation with her that's flawed to its core. And I think she has a much better understanding of their relationship, and handles it a lot more maturely. Like, she doesn't deny her feelings for him. You know, it's not like that. But he's willing to do really stupid things for the relationship. Like, you know, I could see myself thinking that way back when I was 12, 13 years old, right?
Right.
But she doesn't fall into those traps. You know, she handles the relationship a lot more maturely, I thought.
Yeah, no, I think so too. And I understand what you're saying, because the whole dream thing makes it very difficult to put it into D&D terms.
Sure.
Although that is... She is part of, I think, what led me to do a dream sequence in my game.
Oh, right on. Yeah, and actually my favorite characters are the ones that I feel like sort of ended up getting a short shift in terms of their story development. You know, the characters I really wanted to know more about and get more detail on how did they end up this way and where are they going were the Red Wizard, who was in the first book and left early on in the second. I'm like, oh no, I was just, she was like, by the end of the first book, she was my favorite character, you know, and then she's gone. Replaced by the psionic golem, who I sort of, in game terms, would make as a scion warforged, as a way of fitting warforged into the world of the Forgotten Realms, right? And I feel like she had some potential to see where she was going. And I like Thoster, the captain of the ship.
Yes.
And he had some interesting development that I thought could have been highlighted more as it happened. You know, it just sort of his sort of final situation, I thought was just sort of sprung on us without really developing it the way I wanted it to. And I wanted to see what happened to him later.
Right.
Although presumably he survives because their ship, was it called the Green Siren?
I think so.
Yeah.
It's been a little while.
In a later book by Bruce Cordell, Sword of the Gods, which I've discussed in another segment, there is a ship in the docks that makes an appearance called Green Siren 2, and there was a guy on it barking out orders with a large flamboyant hat and what have you. So he sort of threw in this little Easter egg of, oh, look, there's the characters from the Abelethic Sovereignty. They're still alive.
Nice.
Or some of them are.
Yeah.
Without spoiling anything.
One of the things I liked about Anisha was that she couldn't do everything that she wanted to do. Like, that she actually had limits. And that, I really like that. I hate when characters don't have limits.
Yeah, I actually felt like, sometimes that's a trick that D&D books sort of fall into, but I felt like these characters were very human in their depiction, you know? It wasn't just this undying love of the ages that these two characters had between them. They were flawed humans, and their relationship was also flawed, you know? Cain wasn't this guy on a straight and narrow path of redemption and whatever. He had a lot of ups and downs along the route, you know, and his attempted path for redemption actually led him into a lot of his problems because he was so single-minded on it, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, I think, I really liked Bruce's depiction of the humanness of these people. So, all right. That's the Abelethic Sovereignty.
Hello, everyone out there in podcast land. This is Jeffrey Wynn for The Tome Show. And today I will be reviewing two novels. The first is City Under the Sand by Jeff Marriott. And the second one is Sooner Dead by Mel Odom. I hope I am pronouncing that man's name correctly. Let's start with City Under the Sand by Jeff Marriott. This is a Dark Sun novel. It's the first Dark Sun novel I've read. I'm not too sure about this, but I believe this is the first Dark Sun novel to be published since the original series, which I believe was called the Prism Pentad. Some grognards out there can correct me if I'm wrong. This is most certainly the first Dark Sun novel to be published in a while. I've never read the original Dark Sun series. I didn't really know that much about the setting until it was announced for 4th edition. So this was all somewhat new to me. I had been familiar with the basics of the setting, of course. before I picked up the novel. I know that Athas is a desert world. Life there is harsh and unforgiving. Metal is scarce. Arcane magic is feared. And the world is ruled by tyrannical sorcerer kings. So let me just read a passage from the Wizards of the Coast website about this novel. Arik, a half-elf with a rare natural ability with the psionic discipline known as the Way, must find his place in a world ruled by the tyrannical evil sorcerer kings and dominated by the savage wilds of the Athasian desert, a world presided over by the unrelenting crimson eye of Dark Sun. So basically what this book is about is this guy named Arik is a half-elf. He has the psionic ability to detect metal, which isn't really all that useful considering that metal's pretty darn scarce. Or it could be very useful under the right circumstances. The story actually begins with a group of wanderers in the desert discovering this ancient city that had been buried beneath the sand, apparently for untold hundreds of years. And they go exploring, and they find some monsters, and they fight them off. And they find, lo and behold, there is a treasure trove of metal in this city under the sand. And word gets back to the city of Nibene, which is one of the major cities in Athas. Nibene is ruled by a sorcerer king who has the same name as the city. And word of this metal gets back to Nibene, and suddenly everyone's interested in uncovering the metal. And the first half of the story is this expedition out to the uncovered city to try and recover the lost metal. And then the second half of the story is dealing with the consequences of what people do once the treasure is uncovered. Our hero is Arik. He's a half-elf. He has a psionic ability to detect metal, and he is sort of hired by Nibene, the Sorcerer King, to sort of lead this expedition. This is sort of the big break that Arik has been waiting for, because he's been a blacksmith his whole life. He's basically all he's had is his shop, and you know his few meager possessions, and you know his loyal half giant companion whose name escapes me at the moment. Basically, Arik has been an impoverished blacksmith his whole life, and this is the big chance that he's been looking for. This is the big adventure that he's been looking for, and you know he hopes to become famous and become rich and find his father and all that good stuff that adventurers do. In addition to the desert adventure and the survival aspects and all the political intrigue, there's also a murderer who is stalking the streets of Nibene, murdering elven women. And that's sort of a second subplot that gets woven into the story. Other characters are Arik's half-giant companion. He has, I believe, a love interest. Two love interests, you know, one's rich and one's a girl next door, and he has to sort of choose between them. And so, yeah, I enjoyed the book very much. There was lots of action. There was lots of mystery. I enjoyed following the characters. I liked Arik. I liked all the heroes. I thought it was a very good story. It did a good job of portraying the world of Athas for the most part, and I'll get to that later. For a one-shot adventure novel, this was pretty darn good. And if I hadn't known anything about Athas going into it, I certainly would. If you're thinking about if you're a DM and you want to have some idea of what a game set in Athas might be like, this is a good book to pick up, which I think is really the purpose of the D&D novels, frankly. You know, here's what a campaign should look like. That's the purpose of the novels, as far as I'm concerned. And this book does a fairly good job of it. The only negative I would say, is that going by this novel, life on Athos does not seem as harsh as I have been led to believe. Don't get me wrong, the whole world's a desert, there's lots of violence, it's really hard to survive, but there wasn't the sense of hopelessness and the sense of a dying world that I had sort of been led to believe was the nature of Athos. You know, the world sucks, but it's been this way for hundreds of years, and humanity is still somehow surviving. It kind of reminds me of the Flintstones, okay? The Flintstones live in the Stone Age, but they still have cars. They still have vacuums, and their life doesn't seem to be any, different from ours, just because they lived a long time ago. It's sort of the same thing here. There's no metal in Athos, but they've got these giant bugs that they can make armor out of their plates. You know, there's not much water, but apparently there's all these people. They're surviving somehow in these cities. You know, it's hot. It's not very pleasant, but they're surviving. You know, there's arcane magic is dangerous, but we have psionics. So I just get the sense that it's a different world, not that it's a more harsh world. I don't get the sense that humanity is dying out. That's my only complaint about how Athos is presented in this book. So the next book that I am reviewing is Sooner Dead by Mel Odom, and this is a Gamma World novel. And to my knowledge, this is the first Gamma World novel that has ever been written. Anyone knows of any Gamma World novels that came before this, let me know, and I will stand corrected. I have even less knowledge of Gamma World than I did of Dark Sun going into this novel. And from what I understand of Gamma World, it's not even really a setting in the sense that, like Forgotten Realms say, you have, here's this city, and here's the important people that live here, and here are these factions, and here's what their goals are. From my understanding, Gamma World is just chaos. It's the world after the big accident, or the big oops, or whatever they call it. Scientific progress has gone boink, and there's all these weird mutations, and it's kind of post-apocalyptic, like a Mad Max type of deal, but it's also kind of tongue-in-cheek silly. You've got pig people and people with just crazy mutations that's more, it's more silly, more comical, more tongue-in-cheek than it is grim, gritty, harsh, survival-ish. That said, this novel definitely leans towards the more gritty action-adventure than the tongue-in-cheek comic flavor. The main characters of this book are Hela, a human woman with red hair who can turn her hands into guns. She rides on a giant lizard named Daisy, and her companion is a buffalo man named Stampede. The story is almost like a Western. Basically, Hela and Stampede are caravan guides. Their job is to guide people across the trackless wastes of Oklahoma, which I believe is where the novel gets its name. Oklahoma is called the Sooner State, and the book is called Sooner Dead. So it's a pun. Ha, ha, ha. All jokes aside, the story is fairly action-packed. It's fairly gripping and interesting. There's lots of action. There's mad scientists. There's mutants. There's evil robots. And there's a mysterious alien. There's psychic powers. There's moral dilemmas. Everything that you could want in a post-apocalyptic action adventure. I remember reading this novel fairly quickly, and I enjoyed it. It was harder to get into the characters. They seemed like your pretty stock fiction characters. I mean, Hela is the typical action girl. So I enjoyed this novel. The action was pretty good. I read through it fairly quickly. The characters were fairly basic, your basic action hero archetypes, but they were still fun and enjoyable to follow. I'm not really sure how I feel about Gamma World as a setting. I mean, like I said before, I think I don't know that much about Gamma World setting. I know that the game has been around for a very long time. I don't know what previous editions of the game were like. I did get the fourth edition box set, and I remember that box set really didn't have a whole lot of setting. It had a lot of rules and explained the basic premise that, you know, everyone's sort of this half-human, half-mutant creature with powers, and you're fighting, you know, these pig men and evil robots and crazy aliens and forbidden technology. But other than that, I don't really get the sense that Gamma World has that much of a setting. This book tries to give Gamma World a setting by, you know, showing us at least what a part of the world looks like. So, in conclusion, I enjoyed this book. I don't know if I would suggest that people run out and buy it. It's okay for what it was, but I'm not really sure that we need a Gamma World novel line. I think Gamma World as a game stands alone on its own for what it is. So 3 out of 5 stars, pretty average. All right, so this has been my reviews of City Under the Sand by Jeff Marriott and Sooner Dead by Mel Odom. Hopefully you can make sense of what I said. And back to you, Jeff.
Well, we've talked about some books, and we'd love to hear about your recent reads, or have you join us on the Tomes Book Club. We're currently reading the Erebus Kale Trilogy. That'll take us to the end of August.
And we have 2 more episodes. We'll be recording pre-Gen Con, one about the new Elminster novel with Ed Greenwood in the house. And we'll release... which will release on August 2nd to coincide with the release of the book. The other will be this month's book club episode, which will be released in time in the first half of August. Also in August, we'll announce the winners of our contest in a contest announcement episode.
Yeah, and we're being a little bit vague about this whole August thing, because August will be an interesting month for the show, as usual, because it's Gen Con. Both of us will be there at Gen Con, as well as Sam, our editor. So we hope to see you there. If nothing else, we'll hope to see you at the media meet and greet on Saturday at 8 p.m. That's at the house, which is this bar underneath Union Station. It can be a little tricky to find. So if you want to have a little, I mean, it's not real hard, but it's a little bit tricky. If you want a little reassurance or help getting there, we are going to meet at 7:45 outside of the convention center, outside the doors that face sort of the direction of Union Station. And then we'll walk over from there. It's going to be full of bloggers and podcasters, but you need not be a blogger or podcaster to go. Part of the whole point is to have a chance to get together with our audience and actually meet some of you guys as well. So I hope to see you there if you're going to be at the con.
Yeah, and I hope to meet a bunch of people this year, too. It was a lot of fun last year.
Yeah, it was fun.
And Gen Con, beyond meet and greets, also means con coverage. It's a little up in the air what that means every year. So this year,
Should I talk about that?
Yeah, you can talk about it.
I mean, you're welcome to. Typically, Tracy books herself up pretty heavily for Gen Con. So I end up doing a lot of the con coverage as much as I can. I get her, make her help me when I can. In the last year and in previous years when I haven't gone but other people have, I've tried to do a lot of the WOTC seminars, record those, release them. Last year I ended up overlapping a lot with what the official WOTC guys were doing. So I'm trying to communicate with them and coordinate so that we don't have quite as much overlap, and I'll maybe release some of the things they don't release, and they can release what they're going to release, and we'll see how that goes. But I'm also thinking to do a little bit more sort of impromptu stuff along the way. You know, as I run into some of the great personalities or designers or bloggers or whatever, I'll just sort of grab them and say, hey, what have you learned recently? You know, what have you learned at the con this year? What are you really enjoying or whatever, you know, and try to get some sort of those things and put little segments together, or con reports of, hey, you were at this seminar, what'd you think? And what'd you get out of it? Or whatever else strikes your fancy. You know, I'm probably going to take Tracy and lock her up in a room and make her talk for hours and hours and until we get an episode out of it. So.
Yeah. You like that.
She'll do it because I'll pay her in Skittles.
Yeah, anything for Skittles. Although, so hey, can we talk about one thing real quick about Gen Con?
What are we going to talk about at Gen Con?
So RPGA is still looking for judges. So if you're going to be at Gen Con and you don't mind running a game, I would get in contact with the people over at baldmangames.com.
Okay.
Hope that's okay. I just know that they're really looking for judges, and they're going to try to pull me in if they don't get enough. So,
yeah, I was actually thinking, because I was looking at my schedule, I was like, I think I have one or two moments I might be able to jump in if they need it. But
yeah, no, totally do it. Like, and people don't have to sign up for.
But that was supposed to be my time to force you to run a game.
Force me to run.
You're probably already doing something Friday though. Are you packed through all day Friday?
I don't know. Okay. I have to look at my schedule again.
Right. Yeah, I have my calendar open. All right, but if you guys have any other ideas about what kinds of things we should do at Gen Con, and what we should, you know, maybe you really want us to go find this person or that person or whatever, definitely let us know, and we'll try to do that.
How can they let us know?
They can email us at thetomeshow@gmail.com, visit the forums at gamershavenpodcast.com, or call the Tomes Biz Line at 919-BIZTOME with your thoughts, questions, or comments for Gen Con or any other upcoming episodes.
And don't forget to consider checking out the Tomes Amazon store for products discussed in the show and more. Show gets a part of the proceeds, and it helps keep us going.
And real quick, we should also thank our sponsor, Noble Knight Games, as well as anybody else who may have sent in a book review segment, which, again, we don't know who that is yet, because we're recording this one day, and it's not going to be released for probably a week or more. So we'll see what comes in. But if you sent something in, thank you very much for your contributions. Links for things mentioned in the show will be found in the show notes on the website at thetomeshow.com.
We found our way into Candlekeep, consulted the sages of the Silver Flame, snuck into Strahd's library, and found scrolls in the ruins under Tyr in order to find you some reviews about a bunch of novels and books of inspiration.
All to bring you episode 180, book mini-reviews of...
The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome.
I'm on the wall.